Hello and welcome to Lush and the first episode in a new series, Trade Routes, a Lush Insider's look at ethical buying, alternative ingredients and the projects that work to protect biodiversity, the environment and growers all around the world. From a single store in England to a global business, how does what Lush buys impact what you buy? Why is buying at the very heart of determining what Lush is? My name is Charlie Moores and I've been working as a podcaster at Lush for, well, not all that long really, but I've quickly found Lush to be far more fascinating than even I'd appreciated when I joined the company. Lush is a remarkably open and accessible business, and head buyer and perfumer at Lush, Simon Constantine, has agreed to be my portal into a world that I know very little of, but I'm very keen to find out more about. In this inaugural conversation, Simon talks about his recent visit to Sumatra, the palm oil industry, mycelium, and the unusual way we all work here at Lush. Good morning, Simon.
Hi, Charlie.
So, before we get started, let's just establish who you are.
I'm Simon Constantine. I'm a perfumer and I work with the buying team on ethical projects and some kind of vision pieces. That's who I am.
And you travel around a lot?
I travel around quite a bit, yeah. I think there are other people who travel a lot within the business, so I don't want to try and outdo them.
It's not a competition, definitely not.
Yeah.
And the reason we're doing this now is because you've just come back from Sumatra, and I know you can't talk in detail about certain aspects of that trip, but I'm included in a series of emails, and I just thought this sounds the most incredible thing that you're doing, that Lush is doing, because underpinning all of that travel, all of the places you went to, the people you saw, was a very strong sense of ethics, which appeals to me.
Yeah.
To begin with, on this first episode, like I said, well, I know we can't talk specifically about certain projects in Sumatra, but can you give me an idea of why you, as part of Lush, were out in Sumatra?
I think we can talk pretty openly about it. I think there was just some aspects that the guys didn't want to put out there just yet. But I think in Sumatra at the moment, we've helped establish a permaculture project up in the region called Gaya-Lewes. So there's a Lusa ecosystem, which is one of the largest pieces of rainforest in Southeast Asia.
Incredibly important ecosystem.
Yep. And there's a whole series of different NGOs and projects and people trying to campaign to preserve it, protect it from deforestation, from logging, from mining, from palm, from rubber, different plantations that want to go in and extract the resources or find kind of beneficial ways of maintaining that and also finding income. So one of the things that we did, one of the projects I visited, was a permaculture site that was focused in an area that grow a lot of essential oils.
Right.
And unfortunately, the kind of agricultural techniques that they were using meant that they were going into sometimes protected and sometimes unprotected forest, clearing that, planting up just for 1 year to grow patchouli, citronella. Sometimes they grow chili peppers as well. And then because of the way that the amount of chemicals they'd put on, the kind of agricultural practices they were using, the land was no good next year. So they'd move on into further into the forest.
Sort of like slash and burn. But
it wasn't sort of like, it was exactly
it. It was exactly like it.
Okay. We actually did see them slashing and then burning before our very eyes.
I was saying exactly like slash and burn.
It was exactly that, yeah. So going in and, you know, clearing a patch of forest, burning it off and then planting it ready for next, you know, for next year. And that wasn't really a model that we want to be supporting. So we helped to establish a permaculture site there, which really should encourage farmers by example, you know, through physical example, that you can stay on the same piece of land. So if you have your own farm, if you do the right things to the soil, the right things to the kind of nutrient cycles and all of that, you should be able to grow crops indefinitely on that piece of land and not go into the forest.
So it might surprise people that Lush are out in Sumatra advising smallholders on permaculture solutions. I mean, it surprised me when I first heard about it, which is why I wanted to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite a leap in some people's imaginations for a store that sells soaps on the high street.
Yeah, I think that there's been an interesting kind of journey for us through that, because certainly for me anyway, kind of looking back through my career at Lush and kind of wondering how have I ended up at this point, and why do we think these things are a good idea? And I think it's been a natural evolution. You know, we've kind of first we just got interested in ingredients. You know, as a perfumer, I was really interested in just the ingredient. You know, where does it come from? Why is it made that way? Understanding it really from a creative perspective first and foremost, and then realizing it has this kind of ethical impact. And the kind of people that work at Lush and the kind of people who shop at Lush don't really allow you that room to sort of go, oh, it's a bit bad, but who cares? You know, the reason we were in Sumatra in the first place was because of palm oil. It was my 10-year anniversary of first visiting Sumatra, pretty much. Yeah, and I wanted to go back. And the first time I visited, it was because of customers and staff and their concerns over palm oil. And then that led us into an entire kind of decade's worth of work, really, which involves campaigning, involves kind of a part boycott on palm oil, a huge amount of creative work, all of which was really difficult, but actually very worthwhile. Yeah, and it's just interesting to see that whole journey. So for me, I think, you know, the reason that we are in a position to make these suggestions to people and to do the kind of work that we do is all because of this sort of journey that we've been on, and it is very informed by our staff and by customers, you know.
But that almost sounds like an accident.
You could definitely say that.
Oh, yeah. I think we should look at this. Those ethics were instilled into you at a very young age, weren't they?
Some of them were, yeah. I think everybody imagines that the kind of household we were brought up in was very, very strict ethically, but in actual fact, you know, it wasn't. you know, there was a lot of different inputs, you know, so I certainly understood non-animal testing and the, you know, principles of vegetarianism stuff, but we weren't forced to be vegetarian at home. We weren't out in communes or living in kind of, you know, I think people assume that it was some sort of hippie fest. And it actually, you know, right, we went to conventional schools and we did My upbringing, I think, has actually been about finding pragmatic, sort of practical solutions to some of these things, which is what I really enjoy. I really enjoy having ethics challenged. I mean, ethics is a very tricky word just on its own. Everybody has a different set and code.
Yeah, that's very true.
And so it's not as clear cut, really. But what I am interested in, and I've always been interested in, is just being open and kind of transparent about that and being able to show people, okay, we'll listen and we will make an action, you know, especially if we believe it's the right thing to do. And that's all personally I'm comfortable promising a customer, say, yeah, we'll listen to you and we'll act, you know, especially if we believe it's not the right thing to be doing.
Yeah.
And we keep a line of communication open.
Were you shocked on that first visit to Sumatra because the clearances of the forest had already started by then?
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, there's a, you know, there's a nice little podcast series called Turning Point for all those of you at home who are interested in following it.
Yeah. That's a really lovely little podcast.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it kind of challenges people to remember a turning point for you. And it got me thinking about what was one of my turning points. What was it?
We'll have to get you on it. You know?
Yeah. What was it?
We'll record that after this.
We can do that. And for me, one of the turning points that I had was visiting Sumatra because it was about a year after the tsunami had happened. So I had a very different set, you know, different experience to the one I've just had because, I wasn't very well traveled. I had traveled a little bit. This is my first time to Sumatra, first time into a sort of post-disaster, area, which was truly shocking.
This was in Aceh.
Yeah. You know, an area that was severely, I think they lost maybe 250,000 people in a sort of mourning there.
Incredible, wasn't it?
We saw things like, I think they made it into a museum for, tsunami survivors out there now, but, it was a huge power station. That was moored out to sea, about 3 or 4 miles out to sea on a boat, on a large ship. And it got washed so far inland, it landed in the middle of a village and they were unable to move it. So they've actually turned it, I think, into a museum. So we saw things like that live, but also saw misspent funds, you know, a huge amount of funding that went into, you know, a lot of people donated. I think it's still one of the largest donations received for a natural disaster. And it wasn't spent very, very well. You know, you could see that actually the sort of international disaster response stuff was a bit weird, not right. quite what I expected. And at the same time, saw huge environmental impacts in Sumatra in general. You know, so saw the palm oil industry, went to the RSPO, which is the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm, and that was in Singapore, and just saw that that whole struggle to trying to keep in front of this huge environmental behemoth, which was the palm industry. Yeah. And at that point, it wasn't a biofuel. So even then, it was like that was looming on the horizon, that this would also be not only in your margarine and your biscuits and your chocolate and your ice cream and your cosmetics, but in your fuel tank being burnt for power. So, yeah, it was quite a shocking time to be there. And it was, you know, that you had to make a decision. And our decision was to remove palm. We were too small at that point to have any bigger voice in that industry, to remove it from our soap base. But again, you know, it was a tricky thing to do, and it's complex even now, that whole thing.
To reformulate everything, to take palm oil out.
Yeah, I mean, palm oil in itself isn't bad. You know, a palm tree is not evil. It's not looking at you sort of screwy in the forest. You know what I mean? I've seen it in Ghana in West Africa, where it's indigenous and native, and it's, you know, and it can sit there quite happily, and it doesn't have particularly bad impact. But
yeah, it's been used for thousands of years for lots of different reasons.
Yeah, which makes it a bit difficult. And one of the struggles we've got is that, you know, how do you communicate that to staff? We took it out of the soap base. We then found that glycerin had it as a, you know, the glycerin was derived from palm. So then we switched to a palm-free, a GMO-free glycerin. And then gradually we've had to work back through our supply chain. But we're never 100% palm-free. And I think a few people are quite shocked to hear that, because our surfactants and some of the derivatives from palm are very difficult to trace and very difficult to get a line of sight on, and to have conversations with suppliers about. And we've really struggled to get to a point where we're 100% palm free. And in some instances, is that exactly the thing that's required? I don't know. You know, it's still very difficult, because there may be good companies out there growing palm in good ways.
Yeah.
We haven't found them yet.
No.
But, you know, it's difficult to be sort of cut and dry on it. And this is what I think the ethics debate becomes quite complex.
I can imagine it is really difficult to be certain that every product you make hasn't got palm.
Yeah, the majority of palm, the palm industry, I think, is over the last sort of 30 years, you know, maybe even less than that. Certainly a lot of the plantations I visited recently were probably only a decade or 15 years old. And it's very convoluted. And I would argue it's deliberately convoluted. It's a commodity. It kind of pops in one end of a supply chain, bounces around the planet, goes to different manufacturers, undergoes different processes, and then resurfaces in something that is so deeply embedded that you don't even realize it's palm anymore.
Yeah,
so it's very tricky.
It is. You said there that you were quite a small player in terms of the amount of palm oil that you were using. How much palm oil was the Lush using at that point? Have you any idea?
Not really. No, I mean, it was I think we at that point we were using maybe 150 to 200 tons worth of different products that would have been derived from palm. So soap base being one, glycerin being another, and then obviously over time we've grown exponentially since then. So
yeah,
kind of feel relatively good. It's hard to feel really good. Do you know what I mean? You can feel relatively good that maybe we didn't contribute as much. If we'd have continued to use palm, the destruction and the things that we would have been contributing to would have been pretty big for us. But, you know, when you go and look at these huge concession sites, we would have still been a small part of those. But at the same time, we switched over to other types of oils, so coconut or rapeseed, which then give us more challenges in, okay, where do those come from then?
Yeah.
And can we guarantee that those are 100%?
Were they more expensive as well?
Yeah, I mean, that whole process was more expensive for us. It wasn't a straightforward thing for us to do. It cost us a few hundred thousand pounds at the time to reformulate, restock the shops, mess that up, then bring all the soap that we sold to customers that they didn't like, because basically a lot of the soap that we then sold to people, it didn't smell as strongly, which obviously as perfumer was a big no-no.
Right,
but
right.
It also didn't lather as well, or it got blotches in it, and it wasn't a quality, you know, it wasn't a nice standard product and a quality product that we'd want to sell. So we had to recall all the soap base that we originally did and then put out a new type of base. And so, yeah, it was quite a bumpy road. And then obviously that we've had the sort of secondary level to that, which was us creating our own soap, you know, so not just relying on an external supplier for our soap base, but actually then learning how to make soap in-house. And that cost us, I don't know how much that cost us actually, someone will know. There'll be some finance person listen to this going,
yeah, exactly. But Lush always seems to make it has to go down the difficult route.
But ultimately we've learned so much more, and it gives us the ability to take rapeseed from Fukushima or argan oil from Morocco and make soap from it directly, knowing exactly which communities were benefiting, and also actually, I think, creating a better quality soap base at the end of it.
Everything you just mentioned there, like the Fukushima rapeseed oil, is a fantastic story. That was obviously where the nuclear reactor blew up. And Lush is doing some fantastic work on the ground there. He's talking about Moroccan argan oil. There's a full story there. So hopefully we can either touch on those in future episodes or do separate podcasts about them, because this is what appealed to me. I mean, this is the reason why I asked you about, you know, let's talk about why we're doing this podcast as well.
Yeah.
These stories inside Lush are just fascinating. You kind of get the idea that Lush is somehow fixed. But you guys are learning things all of the time and adapting the business as you learn.
Yeah.
So there isn't anything fixed at all. It's a very fluid situation, especially in terms of ethics and trying to source ethical ingredients or from suppliers that are actually going to help the people that are putting the seed in the ground.
One of the things I really enjoy actually about the kind of buying side of things is it's where quite a few different pieces of the business and the real world kind of meet. You know, so there's the ideology of some of our ethics. You know, okay, we don't want to test on animals. We want to have a good impact on the environment. We want to use organic. We want to do all these and the aspirations of the business, which I believe really a lot of our staff and customers believe in with us, and want. You know, that's one of the things that attracts them here. So you almost become sort of an ambassador for the ethics.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you then have to be quite pragmatic and realistic about it. Because you have to go out into the real world and see how you put those into action.
Yeah.
And it's not always a straightforward thing. I kind of imagined when I first started that, you know, you can be quite black and white about it. But then when you come to enact those things, so if it's, you know, maintaining the non-animal testing policy, every year that has to be overhauled and made sure that all our suppliers are still up to date with it, and make sure that, you know, and sometimes they're not. Sometimes things move around. I know it makes a big difference, for instance, on the colours side of things, because those businesses get bought up by big companies that are multinational and do have animal testing strategies in place, which means you can't buy from them anymore. And that's a real pain in the bum. So it's a constantly moving target, and quite, you know, an exciting. So one of the turning points in that palm debate was understanding that you can call something sustainable, but you couldn't really, hand on heart, say that you would want that as a model for the future.
I would really love to talk to someone about how palm oil can be sustainable.
Yeah.
And perhaps there are instances, small instances, where it can be, but to try to claim that a whole industry that's doing so much damage can be sustainable is just ridiculous.
No, and it's really very difficult, and you know, it would be an interesting thing to, like you say, to have a podcast on, or a debate, or, you know, however you want to do it.
The future's been mapped out here. Yeah. We had a series of podcasts in the making.
But I think that whole thing sort of kind of snowballed into what we're now calling sort of regeneration, which is actually finding ways that we can kind of couple with natural cycles and create beneficial growing systems and agricultural systems that help us, that help plants and animals.
So explain the difference between something being sustainable and something being regenerated.
Well, last week it's very clear. You know, I can stand in the middle of a palm plantation and think, okay, there's probably about three different species of birds and a few invertebrates that could probably live in there, and that's about it. You have a lot of artificial.
It's practically sterile, isn't it?
It is. It's like a green car park, you know. Yeah. You can sustain a palm plantation, you know, for however long. You know, you can put some artificial inputs in, some fertilizer and some pesticides and things like that. You know, that will be fine. You know, that will roll along quite nicely. In actual fact, the issues and the problems we've got, they won't be solved that way. You know, you still released huge amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. You still depleted the sort of biodiversity of the region.
Yeah.
So you've got to step beyond that and think of almost like an evolving system that will gradually get more and more natural in its approach, you know, and thinking, okay, a forest doesn't require artificial input. A forest actually builds itself up from, kind of pulls itself up by the bootstraps.
Yeah, exactly.
So how does that work? You know, and I quite like that sort of, I can't remember who said it, but, you know, we're pretty good at taking things apart, but if anywhere is good at putting those things back together, because nature knows how to do that. So yeah. That would be how I would see us taking buying into the future, is trying to be as close to natural processes as possible and providing as many opportunities for biodiversity and for wealth for everybody, you know, for the...
So presumably that would have to be on existing patches of rainforest. You can't reverse the harm that's been done, or can you?
I would argue you can. You know, okay. We saw a very nice example of 500 hectares of reforestation on illegal palm plantations. Okay. So they encroached into national forest, and then OIC, Orangutan Information Centre, the NGO that we were with. In fact, I think they said that we were one of the first to fund a small patch of this to be... Basically, they go and they cut the palm, the illegal palm, down, and they reforest. And they started with something like 20 hectares, and now they're at 500. And it looks like it pretty much... indigenous forest now after 10 years. So if you plant it in the right way and repair it in the correct way, you know, you have got a hope of reversing some of these things.
Yeah.
So I do believe that actually maybe we're at peak destruction and that we can start to move backwards from there. Do you know what I mean? And or forwards in a positive way. I'm not sure. Yeah, either through, you know, it could be reforestation, it could be putting in more complex natural things like that mimic ecosystems. You call it maybe agroforestry and things like that. So yeah, I believe that we can on kind of existing agricultural land.
You mentioned there that Lush funds this work. How does that work out?
I don't know. It's another one of those kind of weird...
Still evolving.
But there have been different ways that we've helped to... So if we take Sumatra as an example again, Charity Pot originally worked with OIC and Sumatran Orangutan Society in the UK, so SOS.
Yeah.
We did a couple of different pieces of funding, one of which at the time was... I remember it was the Orangu van. So they wanted a van to take around, in particular Aceh, that helped. It basically delivered sapling trees and also had a load of reading materials that the younger generation could have access to around orangutan conservation, around biodiversity, and, you know, and kind of trying to train up another generation of people who are interested. So we did that originally. Then we had this contact, so that when myself and the other buyer, Alan, at the time went out, we visited them. And that was our inn in Sumatra. And then that informed, obviously, our move then to remove palm and, you know, a whole load of creative work that happened. So it went from charitable giving into product creation quite fluidly. And then we created the Slush Fund maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and then began conversations with OIC.
To explain Slush Fund.
Okay, Slush Fund.
Because if you're interested in sport or anything, well, that's got a horrible connotation.
Yeah, okay, I mean, it was part of the fun of it, really, was the Slush Fund. We called it that because it was just after this sort of banking crisis and all these illicit pots of money going around that were going to the wrong kind of activities, and we thought, screw it, we'll do something that's more sustainable, you know. And so we started the Sustainable Lush Fund, and it was really trying to identify in particular permaculture projects. And at that point it was like a big experiment for us, because I knew that sustainable wasn't enough in terms of, you know, palm, but we still called it the Sustainable Lush Fund just to get it off the ground.
And so you could use slush.
Yeah, it was mostly for the pun. When we first started doing it, we did have a few little pots of money. The auditors were a little bit nervous when they started going through our finances and seeing that we had slush fund and we put a bit of money in Peru and a little bit of money in Ghana and all these places.
This isn't supporting the president or anything, is it? It was very tricky. I can imagine.
So they weren't particularly pleased with it. But because the first thing we did was send money to Colombia. Now I think about it.
You can see how that could be misinterpreted.
Yeah. But we were just really trying to find ways. And it was quite, you know, it was a fund, you know, with ethics at its heart. But it was also something that we wanted to prove to ourselves, that there was a new model of kind of agriculture that we could sustain and we could promote. And it was something that we could work on. So, yeah, I mean, it was a very interesting kind of few years of experimentation, really, to see, you know, we focused on permaculture projects because they were a network of individuals and kind of groups of people that were working on kind of more ecological agricultural models that were benefiting. I mean, they got the three ethics there, which is people care, earth care, and fair share. So they're really looking for a balance between those three principles, which is, you know, making sure that people were looked after but not at the detriment of the environment, making sure the environment had plenty of work to it, looking to remove chemicals, for instance, and put in more biodiverse areas, and then making sure that everybody had a fair share of the kind of bounty of that, and making sure that people locally on the ground, maybe in Ghana or Peru, would actually benefit financially. We weren't just extracting resource and adding value elsewhere.
It's all being done by the store on the high street that sells soaps.
It's incredible. It's good fun.
It's an amazing story.
We've really enjoyed it. I mean, we've learned so much from it. And then we've had new ingredients come through those channels, which have created products like Magical Moringa or the Charity Pot that got reformulated. And so they've been, you know, they've informed more creative work. So it would be... that's why I never looked at it as charitable donations. In fact, I'm not particularly, you know, I think the donations are nice.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, these are more partnerships. These are more connections to...
Much more longer term than simply throwing a bit of money at a problem and then turning it back on it and walking in the other direction.
Yeah, this isn't really token. In fact, none of our charitable giving is really token at all. You know, I think we've always looked for how can we leverage more benefit to people. It may be through financial gain, but actually it may be through some of our other talents, which could be in making product and selling it on the high street.
How much of this was planned right from the start?
Probably about 1% of it. When I look at it, I think that none of it was planned, but it was all possible. I think that the format and almost the seed of Lush, you know, we didn't start out with all those things directly in mind, but they were certainly, their space was left open for those things to happen. So if you re-ran the program again, I imagine we probably end up in the same place with the types of people that we've got and the ways that we view things and our aspirations. I think that, you know, one thing leads to another, but... it's quite organic.
Yeah. You talk there about other people in the business. This is all through the business, isn't it? So it's in manufacturing, it's in retail, it's in buying, it's all sort of parts of the company have this ethical strand, this way of looking forward.
Yeah.
I don't know because I haven't worked for that many other companies, but I imagine it's quite unusual.
I think, the word unusual, definitely.
I think quirky.
I think you can definitely, you can definitely pin that on us. I don't know, you know, other things people would have different viewpoints on. But one of the things I talked about a few years ago was this sort of looking at natural patterns. And I was deep in sort of trying to understand the ecological world. And mycelium, you know, became this kind of phrase that we coined at the time.
Really,
it wasn't, you know, mycelium obviously is not a phrase I've coined. It's the tendrils of the sort of mushrooms. So mushrooms are the fruit of mycelium. Mycelium are under the ground,
spreading out in all different directions and reaching out
through
the soil,
kind of spaghetti network of different things. And it actually transpires that they connect a lot of different plant species together. So if you go into a forest, this mycelium actually help connect different tree species together by their roots. And it all became very kind of weird. But when you looked at the pattern of it, it looked the same pattern as the internet, or it looks like the same pattern as neural pathways. And it kind of looks a little bit, when you look at how Lush operates, like this kind of weird sort of blobs of different things that are going on and tendrils reaching out. And I think people's connections and interactions and things. And I think we're quite lucky that whether it's very explicit or it is implicit, we do have a general feel of what it means to be in Lush. I think that makes it quite an exciting place to be, and that everybody then can interpret and work out from there how they need to approach a problem, because everybody's in completely different circumstances. If you're working in, you know, the Middle East, for instance, in retail there, you have a completely different set of criteria and restrictions on what you do as you do if you're working in buying team in the UK.
Sure.
But the approach and, you know, the general feel of what we do is the same.
And the fruit that sprouts above the earth.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Is the same worldwide.
You're going with it. I'm glad you're going with that analogy.
I do completely believe in it. I see the podcast as part of that mycelium. And, I came on board Lush about a year ago and I wasn't really given a brief. It was just go and tell stories. I was like, the more I looked at what Lush was doing, the more I thought, actually, I want to focus on what Lush is doing, because if you use them as a hub, the things that you're doing, you know, all of us are doing, almost like spokes in a wheel, or the mycelium, they radiate out, they touch so many other different things. And I think that's an absolutely fascinating way to be allowed to work. It's very unusual, because you're normally told this is what you're going to do. This is the box you're in. You will do this job. And after a few months, you're like... oh, I've done that, now what? But it's like, hey, if you've got a good idea, go
different
and do
people
something.
Have tried to do that kind of thing in the past, and it doesn't work out very well, because I think of the types of people that work here, it's almost like it's become a sort of, you know, it's become its own beast. Yeah. There are a lot of people who don't really appreciate being told what to do, have very strong ideas, strong opinions, and know what they want to get on with. So it's quite good fun, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, it would be very difficult to change the culture within Lush now and say to prescribe their jobs to them.
Yeah.
Just imagine. Be very difficult. Just to finish, Simon, Lush hasn't really talked about what Lush does, does it? Do you think that's beginning to change now? Is this podcast an example of the way that Lush is beginning to talk about itself a little more?
I think we've always had this kind of odd... there's several things that happen at once. One is we would love for everyone to know what we're doing, but we're quite busy doing it.
Yeah,
so
that's very true.
You know, it's difficult to stop and... you know, take stock and go, okay, right, this is what we've been up to. Then we get a little bit, sometimes we swing from being very full of ourselves and thinking we're absolutely fantastic to then being completely kind of, you know, we berate ourselves quite a lot and sort of self-deprecating.
Yeah.
We swing backwards and forwards on there. So sometimes everyone's got a lot of appetite for blowing their own trumpet. And other times you go and you see something or you have a look at your work and you think, oh my God,
really?
That was, I don't feel... I don't feel super good about this at the minute. You know what I mean? I don't want to be up on stage or on a, you know, on a podcast or talking about it. So, you know, individual and as an organization, we swing backwards and forwards on that. I think there is a need for us to talk about it more where we feel like it's got benefit, you know, so not just blowing our own trumpet, but in actual fact, where it's got genuine benefit to people. If we can promote other organizations and charities, for instance, or causes, or we can prevent things from happening, you know, I think that's where we get very motivated and suddenly, you know, our sort of egos get out of the way and we just go for it, you know. So those are the times that I see as aligning a lot more.
Not, if any cynics are listening, to sell more product. That's really not.
No,
point of
I tried that. I'm a terrible salesperson. Me personally,
me too.
I did one
useless
one time. My record of working in the shop. I did a visit one time, and during an entire day, I only sold one box of dirty tutti tabs, which at the time cost £2. So my entire journey and day spent, I just didn't earn my keep.
Oh, I can see the auditors looking at that as well.
I'm not a salesperson.
No,
so yeah,
I actually did a job working for the RSPB as a recruiter. You know, these sort of people who stand by supermarkets trying to get people.
All right.
And I got sacked within 3 weeks for being under my recruitment target because I couldn't persuade. I just didn't want to take money off people. It was no, it's all right. So I will take that.
Don't let me pressure you. But
so
yeah,
no, this is definitely not about that.
Yeah.
So I'm fascinating. Thank you so much. I really hope we can make this a regular feature because I think it is just really interesting what Lush does and how Lush are doing things. And like we say, it's not about the selling. It's about explaining the processes that make the company.
Yeah, no problem. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Simon Constantine, and thanks to the wonderful folk at Storm Restaurant in Poole High Street for both accommodating us and our recording kit at very short notice, and working very hard to keep background noise to a minimum. And thanks to you for listening. If you'd like to hear more from Lush, and our ever-growing archive contains interviews, debates and stories with a wide range of charities, organisations and individuals, please download the free Lush Player app, which is available for both Android and Apple.